Hello and welcome to the Mindful Belly Don't Eat Your Feelings podcast. I'm your host and emotional eating coach, Ellie Rome. I was a chemical engineer, gone health coach, and emotional eating coach after a lifelong sugar addiction. I used to binge eat, compulsively eat, and I had a really toxic relationship with food. I ended up developing a bunch of health issues, thyroid issues, chronic fatigue, and I just felt out of control. I went to a bunch of doctors, was handed prescriptions. No one was really asking why. I luckily discovered functional nutrition and mindfulness tools, and that was the start of my healing journey. And then through years of practice and research, I was able to finally break free from the sugar addiction, from the binge eating, and heal my body. Now I've been able to coach hundreds of people to transform their relationship with food. And that's what this podcast is about helping provide the tools to do that and to really reclaim your power and to feel like your best self each day, because you deserve to feel that way. And it is available to you, which is what's so awesome. So for this episode, I'm so excited to share with you an interview I had with a licensed clinical psychologist named Dr. Nicole Berkins. She has advanced degrees in psychology, education, and nutrition, and she's one of the world's leading holistic child psychologists. She's dedicated 23 plus years of her career to providing parents with research-based strategies that get to the root of children's attention, anxiety, mood, and behavior challenges so that they can reach their highest potential. This episode is great, whether you have kids or not. It was so beneficial. I don't have kids, but I got so much from it and just so much learning from my own, you know, childhood, especially on certain behaviors that drove a lot of my eating issues. Because we pick up what our parents are doing, whether we know it consciously or not. And, you know, my mom's relationship with food, pretty destructive, and that was carried from her mom, and I'm sure from her mom. And so it's just kind of being able to learn about yourself and how to show up with food with your kids, desiring them to eat healthy, but how do you do it without developing shame or developing eating disorder type behavior? And so we dive into a lot of that in this episode. And before we begin, if you are somebody listening that is looking for one-on-one coaching, is someone who is struggling with sugar addiction, binge eating, emotional eating, just really trying to transform your habits, you can set up a strategy session with me at calendly.com/mindfulbelly, and we'll see if we'd be a good fit. All right, let's go to the show. So good morning, Dr. Nicole. How are you?
Good morning. It's great to be here with you.
You too. Well, to get started, I'd love if you could just share about who you are and how you got into the work that you do.
Sure. So by training, I am a licensed clinical psychologist. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, but my work has sort of taken a winding path. I actually started out in the field of education. I have a master's degree in teaching and special education in particular, and so worked with kids from preschool all the way through high school. Ages with a wide variety of developmental, mental health, behavioral kinds of challenges in the schools, and then really got passionate about working with families because the parents were saying to me, you know, it's great that you are doing all this awesome stuff with my kids in school, but we need support, we need resources, like what do we do with them at home? And so I thought that's, you know, something that's so important. And so kind of shifted at that point, went back and got my doctorate in clinical psychology and opened a private practice, a clinic that specializes in working with families who have kids of all ages with a wide variety of needs and really does take a parent-focused, family-based, holistic approach. Along the way, got really interested in the nutrition and functional medicine pieces of that, mainly because we were seeing so many kids who were getting somewhat better with all of the good tools and strategies and therapies that we were doing, but I kept seeing these common threads of physical health kinds of issues, kids coming in with emotional, behavioral, learning, developmental kinds of challenges, but who also had histories of things like chronic constipation, not sleeping well ever in their life, having really picky, restricted diets, having chronic ear infections, throat infections, like all of these things. And I was like, I don't think that this is probably a coincidence. And I started delving into the research and found that actually there's this whole body of research literature on the connections between physical health and mental health, and particularly brain development in kids. And that got me really passionate around that. So I went back and got a master's in nutrition and integrative health to really be able to bring those pieces into the work that my team and I are doing with patients and families at the clinic. And also that has benefited me and my family on a personal level. I am a mom of four kids. They are now 15 through 21. And we've had our own challenges over the years with physical health issues, brain-based kinds of issues. And so delving into the world of nutrition and integrative health has given me some great tools to support my kids, to support myself, my partner. So that kind of brings us to today, the winding path that things have taken. And, you know, I still practice a little bit in my clinic, but I have a wonderful team there. And a lot of my time now is spent teaching and advocating and providing resources for people who don't have access to a clinic like mine. So that's what brought me to do the work I do.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing all of that. I think it's so important and huge. And I, from a personal standpoint, I had ADHD growing up, tons of like eczema, gut issues, things that you said. And no, never was I asked like what I was eating, or my mom was asked what I was eating. And and just now coaching, I coach women a lot with emotional eating issues, but many of them have kids that are struggling with similar things, mental health. And so what do you think is missing so much in the Western medicine paradigm?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the big problem that we have is that we still classify things as medicine and mental health, which is sort of this division between physical health and mental health, which is just factually wrong, but is how people and the profession still think about it. And I think that's the starting point for where we go wrong with really helping kids and adults to function optimally, because the reality, you know, you and I both know, everything is connected. Everything that's going on in the body is completely connected to what's going on in the brain and how our brain is functioning. And what goes on in our brain completely impacts physically what's going on in the body. So that's the first problem, is that we have this artificial separation. And so when a child is, or an adult is having what, you know, might be classified as mental health issues, let's say anxiety issues or depression or mood issues, or a child is exhibiting really challenging behaviors, developmental kinds of things, that gets pushed into the realm of, oh, that's a mental health problem. And no one looks at, very few people look at, why is this child having these symptoms in the first place? And so what happens is parents and kids and adults get shuttled off to therapists, to psychiatrists, to their primary care to get some kind of, you know, medication or treatment for the mental health symptoms. And very rarely are people asked, as you said, what's going on with what you're eating? How are you sleeping? Is your child getting movement? What's the stress level like in your family? Have there been any traumas or things that have come up? Those are things that don't get asked. And so we end up focusing almost exclusively on surface level symptoms without digging into what's actually going on. Why are people having these symptoms in the first place? And what do we actually need to do at a root level to address that? And so that's where I think we end up on either the completely wrong path for people with treatment, or we end up on a Band-Aid path, right? Where people end up with doing some therapies or having some medications that maybe take the edge off or maybe help in some way, but they're still really struggling. And some people actually get worse on the medications and things that are prescribed. So I think it's that lack of understanding the connection between the brain and the body, and the lack of looking at root causes and root contributors to the symptoms that people experience.
Yes, thank you. And so what do you feel like for people who are experiencing, or have children who are experiencing ADHD or anxiety, what are like the lowest hanging fruit? What are the first things you would say to look at?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of the questions that I ask when people come in for an initial appointment And most of the people that come to our clinic have been to see lots of people prior. So this isn't their first rodeo with seeing, you know, a psychologist or a physician for these issues. But they, you know, so many times they say, wow, you're asking questions that nobody's asked before, because I'm asking things like, you know, talk to me about over a 3-day or 5-day period, what your child is eating. How are they eating? What's the schedule of that like? What's their sleep like? When are they getting to bed? Are they waking up frequently? You know, what's the level of school stress? What's going on there? How many bowel movements does your child have in a day or a week? What are the medical things that have gone on? You know, looking at those pieces, because having a diagnosis or even symptoms like anxiety or attention problems or impulsivity, you know, those are just labels that tell us what the problem is. Those labels don't tell us anything about what's driving those problems. And that's what I'm most interested in, is I can have 10 kids with a diagnosis of ADHD come to my office, and each of them may have different underlying factors contributing to the symptoms that get called ADHD. So some of the most common things that I see and that we want to intervene with are absolutely in the realm of food and nutrition more broadly. So what kids are eating, but also how they're eating, because consistency and blood sugar regulation and all of that is a big issue. And we know from the research that that does play a role for the vast majority of kids and adults in these kinds of symptoms. So intervening with the quality of food, the types of food, focusing on blood sugar regulation, but also from a broader nutrient standpoint, we know that many of these kids and adults need higher levels of key nutrients to support their functioning. Whether or not they have clinical deficiencies when we run labs, the research has shown that people benefit from more of certain kinds of nutrients. So looking at the use of therapeutic supplementation, therapeutic nutrients to help them. So those are some of the food and nutrition pieces. Other low-hanging fruit, sleep. Sleep is one of the most underappreciated, under-addressed things in mental health, particularly for kids, because we fail to understand how critical good quality sleep and enough of it is for kids' brain development and brain function. So a child who's even getting 30 minutes less of sleep each night than what they really need is going to have problems with their behavior, with their emotions, with learning the next day. And so we need to really be looking at, is this child getting enough good quality sleep? If not, what's getting in the way of that and addressing that? And I have seen kids make complete turnarounds in their functioning and in their symptoms just from addressing sleep problems that they're having. So sleep is another big one that we need to look at. And then movement and how sedentary they are. The research is clear, kids need enough physical activity and movement to support proper brain development and proper function. And unfortunately, we have a generation of kids that's the most sedentary than any in history. And that was before the pandemic hit. Now it's even worse. And so I think screen time plays a role in here too, because kids are sitting around doing a lot of passive stuff on devices and not getting the physical activity they need. And so often that's a key piece of making some simple changes that can have a big difference in emotional and behavioral regulation, everything from anxiety to being able to focus to, you know, all of those pieces. So I think, you know, those are some of the very simple, but very effective and research-based sort of low-hanging fruit that we need to be looking at that often don't get discussed with parents or kids.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much. And if it's okay with you to, we could dive in a little bit deeper into each of those categories. So like with the nutrition piece, I guess for foods to avoid and then things to make sure they're adding in, what would you say would be like the biggest ones?
Yeah, I mean, it can be very individualized. I'll say at the outset, there's a good foundational way of eating that I think is necessary for all kids, especially if they're having symptoms and challenges. But there are more specialized diets and ways of eating that may be necessary for certain kids, particularly if they have more significant kinds of symptoms and issues, particularly if they have more moderate to severe autism spectrum disorder, more severe ADHD, severe mood disorders, things like that. There are very good research-based specialized kinds of diet and nutrient protocols that can be helpful, but we need to still build those on a foundation of what does it look like to feed our kids in a way that supports optimal brain development and brain function. And so what we're looking at there is really a few key things. The first is prioritizing whole nutrient-dense foods in the diet and minimizing ultra-processed foods. And, you know, I read a study just yesterday that came out showing that there has been a significant increase in ultra-processed food intake in children between 2008 and 2018, where almost 67% now of most children's diets in the United States consist of ultra-processed foods. 67%. And we wonder why we have rampant levels of ADHD and anxiety and behavioral disorders. It's because ultra-processed foods are not nutrient dense. They contain a lot of simple starches and sugars, a lot of chemicals, and they simply don't have the nutrient building blocks that kids' brains and bodies need to grow and function effectively. So you can stay alive, your child can stay alive on a diet of, you know, pizza and French fries and McDonald's burgers and, you know, Doritos and whatever else. There's calories in there. It gives your body energy. But from the standpoint of what building blocks and what nutritional information do those foods bring to support optimal function for kids and for adults, it's just not there. And so we have kids, we have a situation now where kids are eating more than ever before, but getting less nutrition, less of the building blocks, less of the nutrients that they need. And so one of the first shifts to think about is how big of a portion of my child's overall diet consists of those ultra processed foods where you look at the ingredient panel and it's really long. You wouldn't cook with most of those things. It's a lot of chemical names that are hard to pronounce. Sugar is in, you know, some form of sugar is in the top, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 ingredients. You know, what portion of my child's food intake is that versus more whole nutrient dense foods, things like meats and seafood, nuts and seeds, whole grains, fruits and vegetables, because those are the foods that actually provide the building blocks that kids need to fuel their physical growth, to fuel their brain development, and to fuel their brain function in terms of being able to focus and learn and manage their stress and keep an even keeled mood. So I think that's a big one for any parent listening to be thinking about, and really any adult to be thinking about for themselves, but especially if you have kids. And that doesn't mean that you have to throw everything in your pantry out right this instant and start over. In fact, that probably isn't going to work. But to really become aware and to say, what shifts can we start to make? What are some of the snack foods that my child's eating regularly that are not very nutrient dense? What can I start to purchase or make that will be similar to that, the kind of thing that they like? Maybe it's a granola bar or, you know, a certain kind of chip or whatever it is. How can I make a swap to something that's similar, but that is more nutrient dense, that has perhaps less sugar in it, that has less chemicals? So those are some simple things to start with, along with another biggie that you know, people often don't think about, which is hydration with water. And we've got studies showing that many kids are walking around mildly dehydrated, and that has a negative impact on their learning, on their behavior, on their functioning. So that's another simple thing that families can start to look at. Of all of the beverages that are consumed over the course of the day, how much of those are just good old water, and how much of those beverages contain added ingredients, sugars, chemicals, dyes, things like that, and really shifting towards water as the primary beverage in your child's diet, and not even milk. You know, milk Cow's milk is something that a lot of parents think they're supposed to feed their kids. And that's only because the dairy industry has done a really good job of convincing us of that over the last, 50 to 70 years. But I see a lot of kids who are drinking a lot of cow's milk, and this is past the age of like two. Obviously, there's a different discussion around the nutrient profile and things that, infants and toddlers need, but past the age of two, if your kid is guzzling down milk with meals and, throughout the day, that can be very problematic, not only because it's inflammatory and a problem for many kids, but people don't realize how much sugar is in that. There are 12 grams of sugar in an 8-ounce cup of just, whole white milk. That's not even accounting for the fact that many kids are drinking chocolate milk, strawberry milk, those kinds of milks in school, which have as much sugar, some of them, as a can of soda pop. So we want to be focusing on water as the primary way that we're keeping kids hydrated. And that's really supportive of brain function. And then the third thing I would say from a nutrition and nutrient standpoint is really looking at, especially if your child is exhibiting clinical symptoms of things like ADHD, anxiety disorder, autism, mood and behavior disorders, that you are looking at nutrient levels for them, specifically looking at their iron level and having that tested, because iron is very low-hanging fruit for kids with these challenges. And we know that iron status, suboptimal or deficient iron status, can be a huge root cause of ADHD symptoms, anxiety symptoms, developmental symptoms, cognitive problems. So if your child has a suboptimal or actual, a deficient level of that, then not only improving iron in the diet, but also using targeted iron supplementation, obviously with the guidance of a practitioner, because you can overdo iron and you don't want to do that. That can be key to helping resolve symptoms. If your child's not sleeping well and is a really restless sleeper, have their physician check their iron status. That's a key. Other nutrients that are key to look at: vitamin D, magnesium, zinc, B6, B12. These are the big ones that the research shows are most connected to developmental and mental health symptoms in kids. So explore those things with a knowledgeable healthcare provider and understand that even if those levels come back in the quote unquote normal range for your child, they may benefit from additional supplementation of some of those because the research shows that many kids with these kinds of conditions and symptoms do, that even though they aren't clinically deficient on lab testing, they do much better and their symptoms improve when we use higher levels of, therapeutic multinutrient formulas and things like that. So I think to just be aware that specific nutrient levels, certain vitamins, certain minerals, can be really key and important to supporting brain function and just improving symptoms in these kids. I would say those are the big ones in the realm of nutrition, at least as starting points for people to think about.
Yes. Oh, this is awesome. Thank you so much. And what do you feel like for, I think one big part of this is like the actual implementation. And I know my mom used to, and not to develop an eating disorder. So like we used to, my mom would like not buy stuff when we were little, and it made me, I was a sugar addict. So the second we had it in the house, it was like, like Christmas, like, just, so how do you do this without creating that kind of disordered eating in your child?
It's so important that this is the, what we feed kids is important, but how we feed kids and how we do this is equally important, exactly for that reason. Because when we become the food police and when we feel like it's our job to micromanage everything that's happening with our kids around food, we create a lot of issues. And to your point, we create the potential for them to develop disordered eating patterns, issues with their self-image, all of that. So how we talk about food, how we approach food, how we eat is really key. And the goal is not to, unless your child has a life-threatening food allergy or intolerance, which is different. You know, for those of you as parents dealing with that, yes, you obviously need to micromanage until they're capable of doing that on their own. But for the vast majority of kids, we want to make sure that they're exposed to a variety of things. We don't want to set up this idea that you can't eat X, Y, or Z foods. We want to stay away from talking about and labeling foods as good and bad, because the reality is there aren't good and bad foods. Food is food. Food may contain more information and building blocks or less information and building blocks for the body. Food may have a different impact on our brain and our body when we eat it, and we can talk about that. But when we start labeling things as good or bad, black or white, you should eat this, you can't eat that, it does set up a lot of problems in the big picture for kids and just a lot of power struggles at home. And so what we want to do is say there's a place for everything, but what do we want to prioritize? And helping kids, even at a young age, to become aware of how they're feeling and functioning based on what they're eating. And we can model that, right? I'm not perfect with what I eat. And I use the things that I do food-wise that, you know, aren't great for me. I use those as learning opportunity for my kids. Oh man, you know, I had that donut that was in the office lounge and I ate that. And then like a couple hours later, my stomach wasn't feeling great. And I kind of had a headache and I just was like foggy all afternoon, and just spotlighting that, right? Doesn't mean the donut was bad. It doesn't mean I'm bad for eating the donut, but I'm building an awareness for myself and my kids of the impact that that had on me, so that I can use that the next time. And it gets them thinking about that too. So a lot of modeling. I do think the other thing that's key is being clear on what your role is around food and eating and what your child's role is, like what our jobs are. Our job or role as a parent is to determine what comes into the house and what we're serving and cooking and when that's served. That's our job. A child's job or role is to decide whether they're going to eat it and how much they're going to eat, right? And this keeps us out of these roles of being the food police, because we're choosing what comes into the home and what's served. If our child decides not to eat it, that's fine. If they do decide to eat it and they eat a lot of it, okay, that's fine too. We don't want to be sitting there scrutinizing and micromanaging and saying, you need to eat three more spoonfuls of that, or you're eating too much of that, or what did you eat when you were, you know, at so-and-so's house? Because what that sets up is kids feeling like these aren't safe things to talk about with you. They will sneak, they will lie about it, they will do things outside of the home. We want to just keep really open-ended conversation and really send the messages through what we're prioritizing in the home, how we're modeling for them, and how we're talking with them about this stuff. And that's really key.
Thank you for that. Yes. And I guess in the realm, like moving into kind of the like food sensitivities for parents discovering that. So what is your best approach for uncovering if your child does or themselves have food sensitivities?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's important. First of all, there are a lot of kids diagnosed with neurodevelopmental and mental health conditions that do have either frank food allergies or food sensitivities and intolerances that go completely unidentified, undiagnosed, and untreated. And that's really a shame, because sometimes for some kids, you know, making changes in terms of, you know, taking certain things out of the diet has a profoundly positive impact on them. So just understanding that if your child is struggling with anything in the realm of their development, their behavior, their attention, their anxiety, any of that, to at least explore the issue of food allergies and sensitivities. Sometimes, you know, kids will have a frank allergy. Often parents know that because even from a young age, kids developed physical symptoms of that, you know, hives or vomiting or difficulty breathing or whatever right after eating a food. But I have treated kids who had allergies to foods, and the only way that showed up was in their brain function. And we send them for allergy testing, and the allergist is like, oh my gosh, this kid, you know, has all of these allergies to food, but it didn't show up in major physical ways. So just know that that's a possibility. It's more often the case, though, that kids don't have frank allergies. They're not having an allergic reaction. They're having a sensitivity or an intolerance, which is really a delayed allergy. The immune system isn't immediately having a negative response to gluten or dairy or tomatoes or whatever it is, but they're having a delayed reaction. And so what's happening is these kids over time are developing more physiological or neurological symptoms. And the big foods that I see as offenders for that are gluten and wheat, cow's milk, eggs. For some kids, it's corn. For some kids, especially kids with ADHD and behavioral symptoms, it can be salicylates in the diet, which are certain chemicals in fruits and vegetables, but also are in a lot of preservatives, food dyes, things like that, that are in foods. So it can be categories of foods or isolated foods, but it can be really helpful to determine if that's going on. And some of the red flags for that would be if you tend to notice patterns, if you sort of track and you notice patterns around certain kinds of things your child eats, and then their behavior or their issues worsening. If a child is having a lot of cravings for a particular thing, I see this with milk all the time. Kids who are like craving dairy, their mom goes, oh my gosh, they would drink cow's milk, eat cheese, yogurt, like all day long if I let them. That's often a symptom, a red flag that there is actually an intolerance and an opiate reaction in the brain happening with that, that that child would benefit from removal of that from the diet. There are lab tests that we can do, and I sometimes use those, but really the gold standard for determining food sensitivities or intolerances is an elimination diet, is systematically pulling out a certain food or category of foods for anywhere from a few weeks to a few months, and then observing and documenting changes in their functioning and symptoms. The tests can be helpful, but the tests are not fail safe. There are false positives and false negatives with the food sensitivity tests. So really the gold standard is an elimination diet and looking at what do I think might be the biggest issue here based on what the child's eating and what their symptoms are, and then pulling that out for a bit of time to see what you see. I think especially if your child is a very picky eater, has a very limited diet, it's really important to do that with the assistance of a knowledgeable healthcare practitioner, because often you're looking at removing some of the things that are the main source of nutrition and calories. And you want to do that in a way that doesn't compromise, you know, their overall health, but that can be huge. I mean, I've seen kids with very, very severe mental health symptoms, very severe developmental problems, make total night and day changes just from removing something like gluten from the diet or dairy or, you know, food dyes or things like that. So I think it is something important for parents to be aware of, that's an avenue to look at and to see.
Yes. Oh, this is so good. And that was, yeah. I guess when you said the thing about picky eaters, do you have any advice for parents? Because I hear that a lot. Like, my child is just so picky. Like, any advice to help open that up?
Yeah, I'll say something that is going to be uncomfortable probably for a lot of people to hear, but it's true. The vast majority of what we label as picky eating in kids is actually a problem on the parent or adult side of things. And I know that that is uncomfortable, and some people might say, oh, you're blaming parents. No, it's just a reality that a lot of the ways that children get into these ruts or these rigid sort of narrow ways of eating is because we have allowed it, is because of the way that we have allowed our emotions and our needs to get in the way of that. And if you go back to what I said about what is the parent's job related to eating and what is the child's job, when we start getting those all mixed up, that's when we end up with picky eating. I will say the exception to this is there absolutely is a small percentage of children who truly have feeding disorders. These are what we might call extreme picky eating. These are kids who have like only a few foods in their diet that they will eat. These are kids who have a true feeding disorder. That's a different situation. We're talking about the vast majority of, you know, kids who sort of fall into this category where parents go, well, I can't change their diet because they're really picky. Here's what happens. Kids normally, this is a normal part of development, go through phases in the infant, toddler, and preschool years of having preferences for things, right? Saying, oh, I don't like that, or eating a whole lot of something and then dropping it from their diet, or being fussy about their eating. And how we respond to that and manage that determines sort of the path that they get on then with eating. And what happens for a lot of families is a toddler, a preschooler starts, you know, pushing things away or saying, I don't like that, or I'm not going to eat that. The parent then starts to feel anxious and distressed, like, oh my gosh, I need to make sure they're eating enough, or, oh, I don't want them to be upset. We don't like to see our kids feeling unhappy or uncomfortable. And so you get into these patterns then of just giving them the things that they won't fuss about, giving them the things that they like. And then you wake up one day when your kid's in elementary school and you go, oh my gosh, my kid just will eat only these things and fusses about everything. And it's a huge struggle. So we need to stay in our lane, which is we decide what is served and when, and let our kids stay in their lane of how much they're going to eat and whether they eat at all. When we stay in those roles, we really start to break these picky eating patterns or avoid them in the first place. What happens is we start getting involved in their job of, you know, whether they eat and how much and trying to dictate that. And we let them take over our job, which is to decide what's served, what's available, and when that's being served. And so part of getting through this and breaking up these patterns is being clear about those jobs. And that means that the adults have to get comfortable with their kid having some uncomfortable feelings. Your child's not always going to like what's served. That's okay. They're allowed to not like it. There are certain things that my husband and I cook because we like to eat them and we serve them for dinner, and one or more of our kids doesn't like them, and we know that, and that's okay. They can not like it. That's not my job to decide if they like it or not. If they want to feel upset about that, that's completely their prerogative to do that. But I also don't have to demand that they eat it, demand that they eat a certain amount. You know, they can choose, because if they choose not to eat, guess what? There's another meal coming, right? Breakfast will be served at 7. There will be a snack. So this is an important way of looking at it, and to realize too that this doesn't mean that we 100% of the time at every meal and snack serve things that we know they don't like and they're not going to eat. Of course, we want to, you know, if I'm going to make a main dish that I know a couple of my kids really don't like, I'm going to make sure that there's a side dish, that there's something being served in the meal that I know that they will eat. That's how I choose to handle that. Or if that's not the case, I know that at snack time, you know, there will be something for them. So this is how you work on staying in those roles, but it requires us managing our own uncomfortable feelings about the fact that our kids sometimes aren't going to like things and aren't going to feel good about things. And when we allow their feelings to dictate everything about what's served and how food goes in the house, that's how you end up with kids, you know, in third grade who insist your short order cooking, because they want pizza, chicken nuggets, you know, whatever it is that is their narrow preference, and you're frustrated and you want to have a family meal and they won't eat. And so you've got to realize that the majority of the responsibility for shifting that lies on you. And to say, okay, these are the changes we're going to make, and to talk to kids about that, and then say, but it's your choice. You don't have to like it. You can complain about it. It's okay. You know, not everybody likes everything. So I think that's the first really fundamental piece. And then the second piece that's important is exposure. Kids with limited food preferences or picky eating tendencies cannot get more comfortable with a variety of foods if we're not exposing them. So exposure looks like taking them to the farmer's market to see a variety of produce, to touch it, to feel it, to experience it, even if they don't eat it. It means taking them to the grocery store and letting them pick out some different things to try. It means having them cook with you, even if that's little ones. Our toddlers and preschoolers can use a kid-safe knife to, you know, help cut some things up. Even if they aren't eating any of that stuff yet, what that does is it exposes their brain and their sensory system to all of the components of those foods. And what does that do? It builds comfort with it. It builds familiarity, and it makes it more likely that over time they'll eat it. So lots of exposure, even playing with food, painting with noodles and building things with veggies and toothpicks and whatever. And it also means having meals together where they're exposed to foods that everybody else is eating, even if they're not. If you're short order cooking and sitting your kids at the counter in the kitchen to eat their microwavable, you know, chicken nuggets and their fruit cup, and then you and your partner are sitting down to have a nice home cooked meal later on, separate from the kids, your kids are missing out on the exposure to the sight, smell, you know, environment of that food. It's important to have everybody at the table together exposed to that, even if they're not going to eat it. Putting a little bit on their plate just to get used to it, just to have the experience of spooning it on there, even if they're not going to eat it. Having them pass dishes of food around, having them help clean up and, you know, put the leftovers into containers. All of those things are an opportunity for them to get exposure to different foods, and that builds their comfort level and their tolerance and works them towards actually trying it. So those are some starting tips that hopefully are helpful for people.
So helpful. Yes. And I guess for kind of shifting gears into more of like lifestyle and just like stress in the home and how can help better manage for adults and kids. Do you have any starter tips for managing stress?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I would say, especially now that we are like reintegrating into life, like coming out of this pandemic period, it's been interesting because a lot of families have said that they really benefited from the slower pace of life, that while they were, you know, sad and frustrated, their kids couldn't have their normal activities and time with friends and all of that. One of the real upsides was that life slowed down and they realized that stress levels really got better too. When they weren't constantly running around, shuttling everybody everywhere, having this crazy pace of life. So that's one area that I really encourage families to think about from a stress standpoint, both parent stress and child stress. Because guess what? If you're super stressed as adults, that's going to become part of the emotional vibe of the home and of the family, and your kids are going to be stressed too. So what changes would be beneficial for you to make in terms of your time management, what you say yes to, how much you're, you know, running around, and then looking at that for kids too, not over scheduling them, making sure that there is downtime, that you have time together as a family. I think that goes a long way to reducing stress levels for kids. Another piece that creates a huge amount of stress for some kids is the school situation. And sometimes parents are aware of that and sometimes they're not, but really looking at, you know, are there changes that would be beneficial for my child in terms of what's going on at school? Is this type of classroom environment working for them? Is there bullying going on? Like, what's happening? Because kids spend a good portion, you know, of their day at school. And even during the pandemic, if you're a parent where maybe your child is still doing online schooling, that has been hugely stressful for lots of kids too. So looking at what choices you want to make there. You know, if your kid is coming home with a bunch of homework and your family life is so stressful every afternoon and evening of trying to get everybody's homework done and, you know, arguing about it and trying to deal with all of that, guess what? You don't have to do homework. You can opt out of that. You can talk to the school and the teacher about saying, you know, this isn't working for us. My child's not doing homework. Side note about that, there's no research evidence that homework is beneficial for kids up through eighth grade anyway, and minimal homework in high school. So just know that this is actually like a research-based stance. But what I see is so many parents and kids having all of these battles, huge amounts of stress in their home and family life because of these imposed demands from the outside that aren't necessary, aren't helpful, and are creating a lot of problems in the home. So start to look critically at those things and say, what's working and what's not? What can we modify? What can we get rid of? How can we operate as a family in a way that best serves us, our children, and our family as a whole? And I think that goes a long way to helping with the stress levels.
Thank you. And I would love to pick your brain too about just like body image and body dysmorphia and that in relation to starting at such a young age for most, I know for myself, if you have any advice for that.
I think that's become a much, much bigger issue with kids being on devices and particularly social media all the time. I mean, we're seeing more of that clinically than we ever saw before. Unfortunately, there's a lot on the internet. The internet's a great thing. Like, I just want to be clear, like technology brings a lot of benefits to our lives, to our kids' lives, but parents, I think, are generally not as aware as they need to be of the potential downside of that, which is the kinds of content that kids can be exposed to. And we're seeing more and more early preteens and teens coming in exposed to a lot of content that they absolutely should not be exposed to, that they don't have the capability of really processing, specifically around things like body dysmorphia, anorexia, bulimia, all of those things. It's glorified on the internet and on a lot of social media accounts in a way that most parents have no idea is even going on. And they don't have any idea what their kids are being exposed to. So I think that's a critical piece around this discussion of how we support kids in this area, is for parents to be more involved and aware around what their kids are seeing and experiencing and engaging with online, putting good controls and restrictions in place when appropriate, because no 10-year-old child should be exposed to most of what's out there online. And if you're not using screen time controls or parent controls, then your kid really shouldn't have a device. There's just too many dangerous, problematic things. But understanding and having those conversations, raising that with kids. Parents are afraid to talk to kids about these kinds of things, I think because they worry that if I bring it up, it's going to make it more likely. But your kids are already being exposed to it in the bathroom at school, on Instagram, wherever. So talk about it. Say, hey, you know, boy, I saw this, you know, news program the other night about how many social media accounts now geared towards kids are really glorifying and focusing on like dysfunctional eating and body image. And I wonder what you've seen about that. Like, what do you think about that? Let's have a conversation, like open that up and let your kids know that you want to talk about those things, that you are aware of those things being in their world, and you want to be a safe, trustworthy place for them to ask questions, to get information. So I think that's a big one in today's world, especially. The other piece that I would say, you know, aside from some of the food and ways of approaching that we already talked about, is for parents and moms in particular to be aware of what we're modeling and to be aware of how much our kids, even at really young ages, pick up on the things that we say about ourselves and our bodies, the things that we say about other people's bodies, the ways that we approach dressing or eating or whatever, because that does have an impact. You know, I can say to my 15-year-old daughter, you know, you don't need to worry about your weight. You're beautiful. Like, we're all perfect the way we are, whatever. But if she sees me constantly being self-critical, constantly stepping on the scale, constantly being hyper-focused and berating myself for things that I'm eating or the way I look or whatever, guess what? What I say to her doesn't matter. The things she sees me saying and doing are going to have a much more profound impact. So I think we need to be aware of the messaging that we may unintentionally be sending around how we're handling that ourselves. And I think that's why like the work that you're doing is so important, not just for women on an individual level, but also how they bring themselves to their parenting and to their mothering of their children. It has a big impact.
For sure. Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, us being the biggest models, just modeling the behavior that we wish to see in them.
Yeah, yeah. And realizing that it's hard and we're going to screw up. And I think that's the thing with all of this. You know, my number one thing that I don't want to have happen when parents hear me talk about any of these kinds of things or anything related to parenting is that they leave the conversation going, oh my gosh, this is so overwhelming. Like, I totally have screwed up my kid, or there's no way I'm going to be able to do this right. Because look, the reality is we are all works in progress. As parents, we absolutely screw things up more than we get it right. That is a fact of life and a fact of parenting. And to just to own that and be aware of it and go, yeah, I'm going to mess stuff up. That's normal because we're human beings. So the goal here is not perfection with any of this, because that's unattainable. The goal is just as we learn and grow and get more information ourselves, it allows us to make some different choices and to grow and change in terms of some of the ways that we handle things with our kids, some of the things that we aim for. And that to me is what's most important. When we know better, we can do better. And the goal is not perfection, and you're not going to permanently screw your kid up because of any one thing you did or didn't do. And to just try to relieve your stress, you know, with keeping that in mind.
Yes. And I wonder for you, if you're open to sharing, like, throughout your parenting, since you have four kids, what have been like the biggest, maybe like awakenings or shifts you've made that have been like the biggest needle movers for your parenting?
Yeah. I mean, as I look back now, if I knew, you know, 22 years ago, what I know now about nutrition, I would have fed my kids very differently from early on. But I thought I was doing the right things, you know, and I did the best I could at the time with the information I had. And that's what we all do. But that's a big thing that I certainly, you know, have evolved in, grown in my understanding, you know, and learning of that. And even as my kids have gotten into the teen and young adult years, learning and experiencing for myself how my role shifts, you know, from when they were little in terms of, you know, controlling what they eat and what's available and all of those things, like just learning over time, like how that relationship shifts and how we have to let them, you know, evolve into how they're going to handle things and make more of their own decisions. So I think those have all been big pieces. And I think too, you know, over time, I've just learned that each child is their own person. I have four kids. They're all really different, and they've had different needs educationally, different needs in terms of sort of how to manage different things that come up with them. And so I've learned to be really, you know, flexible about that and taking it one child and one decision at a time and realizing that fair doesn't always mean equal. That what's fair doesn't mean that everybody in the family, every kid has the exact same way that things are handled or done. And just that flexibility around it, I think for me has been a big one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I just want also want to ask you if someone's dealing with a child with anxiety and they have an attack or they have, is there any like on the spot tools or for themselves that you recommend for someone with?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that can be helpful for anxiety. I think when a child is, you know, having either, you know, a major surge of anxiety or even a panic attack, I mean, this goes for adults too, but for kids, we want to be present with them and we want to not jump in to try to fix it from the standpoint of you're okay, everything's okay, nothing bad's going to happen, because obviously they know that we can't guarantee that. But to honor and acknowledge what they're doing. Oh, you're having a hard time right now. You're feeling really nervous about this. You know, I get it. I'm going to stay here with you, helping them to do some breathing. There are some great quick breathing tools that can be helpful. I like alternate nostril breathing, and I can even teach, you know, young kids how to do that, belly breathing. So teaching kids some of those tools. Another one that I think is underutilized, and this is for kids and adults, is helping the vagus nerve to do a quick reset from this sympathetic mode where we're in anxiety and panic to settling down by using the power of cold temperature. So if a child is having a really like borderline panic attack or is really worked up, having them splash some cold water on their face, drink some icy cold water, even lie down maybe like on a tile floor that's cold, or hold an ice pack on a part of them. What we know is that excuse me, really sudden cold temperature helps to do a reset with the vagus nerve and helps sort of shock the system out of this anxious, panicky, revved up mode into a more calm and regulated mode. So that's a super quick one that parents and adults can use.
Oh, wow. I know, that's awesome. Thank you. Well, beautiful. Thank you so much for everything you shared. And is there any, I wonder for just like last question, if for someone starting out on this journey, who is like maybe yeah, very new to all of this. Mm-hmm. Would there be one final piece of advice you'd share with them?
I think just to stay curious and ask good questions, to not assume that if your child is struggling or has gotten a diagnosis of something, that you've been given all the information, or that you even have an understanding of what is causing those things, to just continue to be curious and to ask, what is going on here? How can I best support my child? What's working? What's not working? And just stay curious and flexible one piece at a time around it. I think, you know, and ultimately the best thing we can do for our kids, whether they have extra challenges or not, is just be there to support them, to hear them, to love them, to let them know we're there. That ultimately is our most important job as parents, and it goes a long way. So
beautiful. Thank you. And where can people find you?
Yeah. So my website is drberkens.com, drberkens.com. I've got lots of videos, articles. You can find my podcast there. The Better Behavior Show is my podcast, where we have two episodes a week covering all of these kinds of topics and more. It's a very popular podcast. You can find that on all your podcast players or my website. And on social media, I mostly hang out on Instagram. I've got a really big, great community of families and professionals and parents there. And I'm at Dr. Nicole Berkens on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube and all the rest. So come find me, and would love to connect further with you. And I hope that all of this was helpful.
Yes. Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Nicole.
Thank you.